Hello everyone, it's time for another OneLiner.com podcast. You'll be shocked to know that I am Craig, and as always with me are Drew Tavendale.
Good evening.
And the man who we can only describe as Scott Morris.
Hello.
Oh, for goodness sake, put some back into it, man.
Hello!
That's better. It's a packed episode for you because, of course, we've left you hanging for quite some time since the last... Not that we ever do that, of course.
Thanks, Virgin Media.
Yeah, it's a packed show, so I suppose we'd better rattle on. Award season's died down now, and I suppose it's that time of year, the first real sort of blank spot in the cinematic calendar. This is the time when people sort of rush out loads of stuff that really, you know, hard push to get a slot any other time. But looking at the list of stuff we've got to cover, I can't actually say we're that badly catered to, I suppose. First up, let's take a look at Shame, the highly anticipated new drama from Steve McQueen. Who'd have thought he would be directing such great films from beyond the grave, and that also he would have become black?
That's a different Steve.
Oh, no. Shame sees yet another pairing of director Steve McQueen and actor Michael Fassbender. Fassbender here playing someone with, oh, what a burden, a sex addiction. Scott, what see ye of Shame?
I was not overly enamoured with it, going against the mould, I guess. One of the more well-respected films of last year. Brandon is Michael Fassbender's character. Successful New York executive, centrally located Manhattan apartment, seems to have everything, and, as you say, completely addicted to the old in-out, in-out. Whether it's with one-night stands, prostitutes, pornography, Mother of Palmer or five daughters, anything, he'll take it. His lifestyle gets slightly complicated when his sister shows up to stay. Carey Mulligan plays Sissy, sometime lounge singer with enough issues of her own to be getting along with. Puts a slight cramp in Brandon's style as the pair seem to get kind of close to having frank discussions regarding whatever the hell it is that fucked them up so badly. But they never quite get there, and it does, I suppose, give the relationship between them a mysterious air, but it's really about the only engaging aspect to either of their characters, which is a bit of a problem in a character piece. Both of the leads are too damaged to be relatable, and even when Brandon shows moments of vulnerability, I find myself too cut off from him and his drives to care one way or the other about his fate. You see, Shame's a really well-made film on a whole bunch of levels, and I feel a little bit guilty for not liking it. It's the sort of film that any kind of self-respecting internet-based film review vector ought to be falling over. It's impeccably acted. There's a consistent vision and a sense of style that's quite rare in modern filmmaking. There's a lot of good things in there, but it's just outweighed by characters that I just don't care about. They're both so far outside my scope of experience that I just can't bring myself to care about them. I couldn't work up any empathy for either of the two characters. And let's be honest, the starting point of a rich white guy slash sex hound isn't automatically engaging anyone's sympathy gland, so it's already starting at a bit of a disadvantage. And a lot of the respect that it gets seems to come from its study of sex addiction, which is underexplored area in cinema, I suppose. But if this had been about, say, heroin addiction, would have showed up on anyone's radar. I'm not sure it would. I didn't enjoy this. It's not exactly the sort of film where enjoyment really figures into the value proposition, though, I suppose. No sane person would enjoy something like, I don't know, Requiem for a Dream, but you'd still recommend it as being an engaging and a powerful film. But there's none of that in Shame, which is odd. I mean, I think all the elements are there. It's just nothing in there that really grabbed me. And I wound up being very bored by a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And that's really about the worst thing you can have for a film. And again, it's just given how risk-averse everything else in this world is, how many times you go into cinema and come out being completely unimpressed by whatever's on the screen. It's no vision or scope or anything. It's, well, a lot of things that are coming out these days shouldn't give it such blanket statements. But there is that in Shame. That's kind of what I want to see more of being made. It's just a shame that I like the idea of Shame more than I like the actual film Shame.
Well, I've got to be honest with you, a fairly basic, childish summation of the film there. Drew, I understand you've got something far more lyrical to offer us on the subject of Shame.
Yes, mine is so much more eloquent than Scott's, and my recollection of both the content and my impression of the film now come several weeks after having seen it to actually talk about it was Boz.
There was quite a bit of that in it.
Yes, yeah. Which I rather think seems to have been quite a part of the hoo-ha, which is pathetic. It's like, oh, you see Fassbender's Willy? Oh, don't care.
To be fair, to be a good it film. Is luscious.
Fassbender's boobie!
For the most part, I can't disagree with what Scott said. I'm not sure to say that the acting was universally excellent. I wasn't so sure about Carey Mulligan's, but I guess she's given so little to do that that's maybe just why. But other than that, I guess the characters aren't engaging, they aren't interesting, not any way likeable. It's like, there's this rich guy, he likes some sex, right? Oh, right, that's your entire film. Okay. Yeah, I can't recommend, I can't get behind it. And if you really wanted to see a film about sex addiction, watch Choke.
So, The Iron Lady, which as far as I can tell, won an Oscar for Meryl Streep for Best Impersonation. it would purport to be...
Wait, hold on, just add to something there. Are you suggesting that perhaps the Oscars aren't worthily awarded?
Well, let's not go over that. God knows how many minutes we've wasted over the years talking about that crap.
I can't remember us ever mentioning that at all.
Mm-hmm. Meryl Streep, Maggie Thatcher, you know the rest. Guys, I haven't caught up with The Iron Lady yet. It's not really something that I'm particularly bothered about. I'll take most other critics' opinion on it at face value. From what I can gather, it's a little bit too lightweight to be considering a classic. Is that right, Scott?
It's just a bizarre focus that it takes, is really my takeaway from it. It's just so oddly focused. And even as someone who's, I think all of us around this table, are really too young to have had the full Thatcher experience, but there's no escaping from a reputation in Scotland as being on a par with most war criminals and tin-pot dictators, which we would probably accuse her of being in our more hyperbolic moments. So I suppose it's a stroke of genius casting Meryl Streep in the role of the Wicked Witch of the Tories, because there's nothing around here that we hate more than Meryl Streep and Margaret Thatcher, so that works out quite well for us. At any rate, this is a biopic, kind of, but it's got the most strange framing device I've seen in any film I've seen. And that's about, so someone who's, at least in some circles, a respected, you know, world, important world figure. It takes a really brief, hagiographic look at Thatcher's decision to enter the world of male-dominated world of politics, especially at the time, from comparatively humble origins. It covers sort of really briefly her election and a rise in the party and some of the major decisions that she makes. It's not really an investigation into her worldview. There's no dissenting opinion presented almost anywhere in the film. The only real criticism comes from Geoffrey Howe's blistering 1990 resignation speech, which is excerpted in part here, and shows the depth of feeling that Thatcher engenders, as there's no other way to combine Geoffrey Howe and blistering in a sentence. But this film's not really about her policies and her politics, so I suppose there's no point going to her usual disagreements with them. But what all of it really is this strange framing device where it is Thatcher, suffering from dementia, talking to the memory slash ghost of her dead husband Dennis, played by Jim Broadbent in this instance. And obviously Thatcher's in frail health, going by her public appearances, as you might expect from an 87-year-old woman, but whether any of this is even remotely documented or true is almost irrelevant. I mean, even if it is true, the fact that you're making a film like this where almost all of it is her talking to a dead person is just... It's ghoulish. Inventing a speculative mental health episode just as a framing device is just bizarre. And it's really
wrong.
Distracting. Right, this is the most remarkable thing about The Iron Lady is that it made me feel sympathy for Margaret Thatcher.
And that is remarkable.
Yeah. It's just so exploitative, and it just made me feel a bit dirty watching it. And it doesn't say anything. It's not even giving you a proper idea into her or anything that she's doing. I mean, God, there's scope for some really good films about Margaret Thatcher. This isn't one of them.
No, that's what strikes me, is that everything I've read about this suggests that it's so incredibly lightweight, and yet I can't think of many more characters in history about whom you could... There's more than one film to be made about Margaret Thatcher.
You could make a film just about her during the Falklands War, let alone anything else.
Mm-hmm. You could make a film about, you know, about her time in politics before she became the leader of the Tory party. You could make a whole film about shit that was happening with the Falklands War. You could make a whole film about the miners' strikes. You could make bizarre that, like you say, they would choose to take this weird featherweight approach, and it's like, to me it seems almost impossible that surely by accident the film should sort of stumble more deeply into the topics that Margaret Thatcher engenders. This like amazingly divisive character in Britain's recent history. How can you possibly avoid some of the heavier stuff? I don't understand it at all.
I mean, it's obviously a very deliberate decision, and it's puzzling because I get the impression that if you'd asked Thatcher in her prime, it's the absolute last thing she would have ever wanted, is to have a film about her that focuses entirely on her character and her motivations. She would be the first person that says, it's not that I'm a woman that's the important thing about me, it's the fact that I'm doing this, this, and this, which I think is valuable for the country in radically reshaping society.
Yeah. The fact that regardless of whether or not you agree with their decisions and the outcomes of them, she's one of the few politicians who was actually prepared to make ridiculously tough decisions and not apologise to anyone for it.
Her ideas are far more important and far more interesting than her. Yeah. And I think she would be the first person to admit that.
Yeah, it's like as if Richard Attenborough had made Gandhi and it was all about what clothes he wore.
Or what difficulty he had getting his prescription made up.
So yeah, it's certainly not enjoyable, and it is just so strange and bizarre. I can't think why anyone would particularly want to see it. It's not even one for Thatcher fans. If you did like her, I suspect you'd be disgusted by the way she's exploited in the making of the film. And if you don't like her, then this is not going to give you any sort of any kind of explanation into why you might want to change your mind or whether her policies were necessary or anything. It's a complete bit of fluff.
Yeah, it's not going to back your opinion of her up
or challenge her. Either way.
Very strange. I mean, obviously, like I say, I haven't seen it, and the overwhelming opinion I have of it is as a film that in, you know, not even so many years to come, I think people are going to look back and go, Jesus Christ, was that a missed opportunity?
Yeah. I'm absolutely stunned that people would think this is an acceptable film to release, even if it was, you know, 40 years after her death, and we're going, well, this is a kind of way to wobble around things, but when she's actually alive, this is...
The thing that most people talk about in release of film, I suppose, is Streep's performance. And before we move on, just the definitive Scott word, is it a performance or is it an impersonation?
Definitely an impersonation.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Mm. Those bastards. From a film about a character who gave a foot up the arse to the yuppie movement of the 80s, to a film about the inevitable bursting of the bubble that began with that particular period. How is that for a seamless link? God, that's
a nice segue. You're ruined by adding that self-congratulation onto the end of your sentence, though.
God, I'm a legend.
But it was a good segue.
Thank you, man. Thank you. I expect nothing less from myself. Margin Call. Drew, tell us about Margin Call.
So, here's a novel twist. A film about investment bankers that portrays them not so much as one-dimensional, amoral, money-obsessed bastards... pantomime villains for us to boo and hiss at, but portrays them as humans. and that even manages to make us feel sorry for them. Or at least some of them.
So I couldn't keep that up any longer.
Oh, I'm disappointed.
Or else it was about to become real. Good gracious, sorry man.
No, not at all. So, on the eve of the 2008 financial collapse, an investment bank is laying off staff. As he leaves, one of the sacked employees, Eric Dale, played by Stanley Tucci, hands a USB drive to one of his younger colleagues, Peter Sullivan, played by Zachary Quinto, and he urges him to look at what it contains. Doing so at the end of the day's trading, Peter manages to work out the maths that Tucci had been missing, puts the missing link into all the equations, and when he puts it all together, he comes to the inescapable conclusion that, in the parlance of our times, the company is fucked.
Eloquently put.
I thought so. A nice ring to it. He brings it to the attention of his boss, and he in turn to his boss, and so on. And soon, a lot of very important people are very awake in the middle of the night and very, very worried. A long night lies ahead, as those of power try to decide if A, Peter's findings are correct, B, if they are, whose fault it is, and C, what the hell they're going to do about it. And what they do about it is really an irrelevance in terms of film, but I think that was a terrible sentence. Ignore that. It doesn't contain a great deal more than talking, Margin Call, and there's no grandiloquent dialogue. So director J.C. Chandor relies on his superb ensemble cast to paint a believable and engaging picture with cool delivery but a clear emotional core. Kevin Spacey's the standout. Adding to his usual intellectual prowess, he has a palpable moral pain, particularly when he's got to lay people off or ask people to do something against his own moral judgment. But really all involved acquit themselves particularly well, even those like Demi Moore, believe it or not, who have limited screen time in which to make an impact, but certainly do. This is intelligent filmmaking, and it portrays flawed, complicated, but above all, human characters in a morally challenging and highly stressful job. And it does so rather refreshingly in as non-judgmental a way as possible, and it respects its audience's ability to understand its contents and trusts its audience to make up its own mind. And that makes it almost certainly the best drama about the financial industry yet made, or certainly that I have yet seen. And it's highly recommended viewing. It's nice to see something that's so intelligently made and treats its audience with such respect. And even though it contains financial jargon, it does it, you know, it doesn't dumb it down, but it does it in a way that, if as long as you're vaguely smart and paying attention, you can follow along and understand why it's important and what's roughly happening.
Is that why I got a 15 from the BBFC? Is it contains sustained financial jargon?
I think it means it's, you have to concentrate for more than a minute, which is more than most films do.
Mm-hmm.
It's really refreshing to see something quite so smart, and the thing this is about, to be non-judgmental, is almost miraculous. And yes, it's just, it's a very, very entertaining film. Thought-provoking too.
Ooh, is that an opinion with which you would concur, Scott?
Absolutely. Yeah, very much enjoyed it. Got to wonder if the public consciousness is ready for a film that is not just portraying anyone even remotely related to finance as some kind of pantomime villain, but it wouldn't be for want of trying. This is a very, very well-crafted film. Many great performances across the board. I don't think there's a bad one in there.
No, I
like the dialogue, actually. It's not overly lucidious.
I liked that it wasn't grandiloquent, that it was like quite calm and measured and cool. It wasn't sort of grandstanding or anything like that.
I had that kind of short, snappy-ish, mammy-ish kind of thing going on.
It was terse, but it was really quite believable.
Yeah, yeah. Very sharp, sharply observed. I liked, even wound up liking quite a few of the characters in there. Yeah, fabulous performances. Very much enjoyed it. One of the better dramas that I've seen so far this year. I basically agree with what Drew says. There's not much more I can add to it, but yes, I back him up thoroughly with his opinion and direct you to Margin Call at your earliest opportunity.
Alexander Payne, what a guy. He just doesn't make bad films. The Descendants is not a bad film. It's quite the opposite. It's a good film. Scott, isn't it a good film?
That's all right.
Oh my goodness. No, tell me you have more love for it than that.
Well, do you want to tell us what it's about, or will I?
You go for it, man.
Okay.
I haven't prepared anything.
Neither have I, only finished watching it like a couple of hours back.
Oh, cool.
So George Clooney plays Matt King. He is he's described here as a land baron according to IMDb, but that's not accurate.
He's arbiter of the family estate, is he not?
Yeah. Yes, he tried.
A land baron. Is he from the 19th century?
Yes, yes. He challenges people to duels.
He is in Hawaii. His wife is in the hospital after a tragic boating accident, and his two daughters are kind of running amok in the wake of this. So he is trying to sort out a land transfer deal, which is apparently mandated upon him by the government, and also try and reconnect with his family. Stay in touch with them and just reconnect with his family unit, I suppose, is a concise way as any to put it. Now, The Descendants, for about an hour, maybe, of its running time, had all the elements of a film that I would really like, but it just was not hitting with me at all. It was just bouncing right off me. Good performances, it's a believable characters, and I liked everything in there, but it just really wasn't connecting with me on any level. I think it got an awful lot better in the kind of last half hour, 45 minutes.
Mm.
I think it took a while for Matt King. Clooney's character is sort of very calm and in control for the most part in all this film, and I think it kind of, his disconnection with his reality was sort of reflected in my disconnection with the film. And it only towards the end where things start to affect him a bit more, and where he gets a bit more emotional about a lot of the impending death of his wife, as we find out as it goes along. Her wife's not going to make it, and a lot of it's concerned with people paying their last respects. And it was only when that kind of mask slipped a little bit that I started relating to the character a little bit more and warming up to him. And so, yes, I very much enjoyed the last half hour, and it was certainly worth suffering. It's not exactly a bad film, but I wasn't fully on board the first hour or so. But yeah, the last half hour really made it worth staying around for, and I very much enjoyed it after that. So I can't give it an unalloyed recommendation. It would not be the best film that we'll talk about in this podcast, for example. There's a few other films that I enjoyed more, but it's certainly a very good film and definitely worth a look for anyone who's in the mood for something, for a mature drama that is very grown up, and it deals with these life and death issues in a non-sensationalist, and it doesn't try and non-sensationalist way. It doesn't try and pull on heartstrings where it's not warranted. There's no like grand orchestral as people die or anything like that. It's all very it's very grounded, and I can respect it for that.
That was grand and orchestral. I really enjoyed The Descendants. It does have a somewhat lackadaisical pace, but then you kind of expect that from Alexander Payne, really. Mm-hmm. It's one of his signature moves, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I totally get what you mean. It's quite difficult for about the first hour of the film to really, although you can kind of broadly empathise with Clooney's character, you can't quite make the total connection. He seems frustrated at worst, but sort of coping with all this stuff in quite a sort of nonchalant way, compared to how I think most people would probably react to it. But then by the end of the film, I suppose you realise that that part of his character is, I suppose, the redeeming part, and the part that helps him sort of set the example that gains his daughter's respect, and how he deals with one of the revelations near the end of the film. But I mean, I loved, I think the three of us universally would laud About Schmidt to death.
Yes, indeed.
What film that was. And then, like, I enjoyed Sideways, but I wasn't in love with it as much as a lot of other people I know watched it. Like, I think probably you, I think it's safe to say, if I remember correctly, you guys enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed it, but you guys enjoyed it a lot more than I did.
I think both of us picked that as a film of the year that year.
I think you did, yeah. I think you might be right there. Like, and I felt this slight disconnect with it, and I don't know if it was the characterization or what. Well, The Descendants is somewhere in between the two for me. Like, I really enjoyed it. Like, I'm not gonna rush out to buy it or anything when it comes out retail or anything like that, but I'm glad I got to see it. I would like to say that I'd had the chance to see it in the quiet of a well-behaved cinema audience, but unfortunately the guy two seats across from me was trying to impress this girl by talking really loudly throughout the whole film, and there's very little I could do about it because...
The next person is dead now, yes?
No, because there was a row of about five of his mates sitting behind him, so...
Denied.
Exactly. As much as I would have liked to just not have said anything and just literally knocked his teeth down his throat, unfortunately, I feel it would have been visited back upon me tenfold. But yeah, I really liked The Descendants for all its sort of lackadaisical disconnect. I still felt that Clooney's character was served quite well, and that I suppose that his redemption was quite satisfying. It's difficult to talk about without giving anything away, but... Well, I think we already have, man. The wife dies. But there's other stuff in it. stuff in it that matters. I think it's like an open secret that that's what happens there. It's pretty much, you find out early on that she's going to die. Yeah, I don't know. I found it quite, in a sense, it's quite uplifting. And I think gradually over the course of the film, actually, most of the characters, especially two characters in particular, his younger daughter and her friend Sid, who are immediately annoying and brattish, actually, by the end of the film, you feel some empathy for him, actually. It's a fantastic performance from, who's the actress who plays his daughter? Is it Shailene Woodley? Is it Alexandra's daughter?
Alexandra's the elder daughter, Shailene Woodley, and Amara King. Miller's the younger.
Oh, right, okay, so Amara Miller does really well, and she's quite a mature performance in a role in a film like this, and I really enjoyed The Descendants, man. I really enjoyed it. And yeah, I'd recommend anyone see it, but like you say, it's not, I'm not sure quite why it seems to have set the world alight for so many people, but it certainly made a bulb glow.
I like to think it's because it's another drama where, like Margin Call, it's not treating you like a child.
Yes.
Who is there to be, you know, orchestrated to. It's, it credits you with some intelligence and lets you explore these characters at its own pace and at your own pace, and it doesn't have like overly simplistic moral choices about everything, and there's no preaching to it. Even when Clooney's trying to correct his children's path in life, he's not doing it by, you know, overly moral preaching.
I think, do you know what actually sums it up? It's a film which centres around essentially a bunch of quite privileged people living in Hawaii, and by the end of the film you don't hate them. for what other people, I guess, would find quite sort of trivial life problems this drama's made of. That's a good way to look at it. Interesting you say it doesn't treat you as a child, Scott, because if you do want to be treated like a child, albeit an intelligent one, then maybe The Muppets would be the film for you. Drew, fill us in on The Muppets.
Oh, The Muppets is something of a reboot, really. It's been a while since the Muppets were on the big screen with the less than stellar Muppets in Space, and there's been a number of pretty woeful, quite frankly, by all accounts. I've only seen one of them. Oh, I saw 10 minutes of one of them myself. It was all like a stomach TV movie since. Mm. This is a attempt from Jason Segel, who's apparently a bit of a Muppet fan, to put it mildly, who's been trying for 5 years now to get this film off the ground and get the Muppets back to the anarchic, fun variety that they used to be known for, that made everybody love them in the first place. So the story revolves around Gary, who's played by Jason Segel, who takes his fiancée, Amy Adams, and his brother Walter on a trip to LA. And that's a treat for Walter, who is the world's biggest Muppets fan, and unlike his brother Gary, happens to be made of felt. they take the Muppet studio tour, only to find that all of the Muppets are gone, and the studio is dilapidated. And while there, he inadvertently overhears Chris Cooper's pantomime villain Tex Richmond's plans to level the studio and theatre so that he can drill for oil beneath it. It turns out that if a sufficient sum of money can be paid before a deadline in just a few days' time, the studio can be saved, so Gary and Walter hatch a plan to get the Muppets back together, and they stage a benefit show to raise the cash. The snag, though, is that after the fame dwindled, the Muppets went their separate ways. For instance, Fozzie's in a Muppets tribute band in Reno, Animals in Anger Management, and Gonzo sells toilets. And, I mean, there's not a great deal of plot to that, which is what kind of works. It's just like, he hears a vague MacGuffin for the Muppets to do. In this case, it's put on a show to raise money and go and be some Muppets for a while, which is exactly why it's great. And all the Muppet staples are in here. There's the appalling puns, the impromptu musical numbers, celebrity cameos, perhaps less stellar than they've been in the past, but they even amazingly include a more than tolerable Jack Black. Now, there's a thing. And, you know, typical pop culture references and explosions, and not an ounce of cynicism. It'd be hard to categorise this as a family movie, I mean, as you said, Craig, about being a grown-up kid. Something like that. I forget exactly your words, so my apologies if I'm misquoting you.
I'll never forgive you.
Yeah, another thing to add to the list. Yeah, so while I'm sure that kids will enjoy the music and the mayhem and the coloured lights or whatever it is children like, I can't remember now, so long since I was one, but they're certainly not going to get, for instance, 80s Robot. genius as that was. So this film is decidedly for the adult fans, the ones that, like us and Jason Segel, grew up with the Muppets. And this is the Muppets at their best. It's absurd and anarchic and surreal, and it's absolutely brimming with joy. And it's highly recommended. It's just so much fun. Yeah, there's not a great deal else I can say about that. It's really fun. Please go and watch it.
That
so
it
they
is.
Make more.
I have to say I enjoyed it immensely. I felt perhaps like the second... I think maybe the second half of the film was a little... Sort of, there was a slight sag in it, but I've got so much goodwill riding on the Muppets that it's hard to kind of pick fault with it. If I was being really, really picky with you, I would say that I found Chris Cooper a little bit sort of stiff in the role, and I don't know if maybe he wasn't willing to let himself go properly, or if maybe it's just the burden of the man's character, but he didn't seem to quite embrace the anarchy of it. He wasn't quite manic enough.
I'll agree with that a bit, that he's perhaps stiffer than you'd perhaps ideally want, but he still on screen does a completely ludicrous rap video, which is one of the highlights of the film, and I think that would, you could let the other stuff slide, because he does get involved in that.
He does, bless him for that. I should perhaps go easy on Chris Cooper, but man, all I can say is that I just had such a good time, such a good 90 minutes watching the Muppets, that I'm not gonna really pick any fault with it, so do one. I loved it, Scott.
Film of the year.
I thought you might say something like that.
No, loved it. Yeah.
It's so fun, isn't it?
So
can I give your opinion on your behalf, Scott? Because I'm just gonna bring up the text message you sent me.
Feel free.
My opinion of the Muppets can, unfortunately for us, only be expressed through emoji. And it is. And graphically we have representations of thumbs up, crying with laughter, crying with laughter, arrow through the heart, arrow through the heart, clap, gavel.
It's Gavel that really, yeah, really sells it.
That was judgment being rendered.
At which point I thought, I think Scott perhaps enjoyed this even more than I did. Oh yeah. My goodness. Sorry, on you go, Scott.
No, that is essentially all I want to say. Gavel. Oh, loved it. The only real criticism I've seen of it is completely irrelevant. I think a lot of people don't like Jason Segel for whatever reason. Maybe they're just sick of How You Met Your Mother or whatever. But these people are mental and you should not pay any attention to them.
Yes, they are mental. But even if you don't like Jason Segel, right? He does what the human characters in Muppets films should do and typically have done. It's like they get out of the way for most of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's not there much. He's more involved in the writing than being on screen.
Yeah, I have to say that I had reservations beforehand because of his involvement with the film, and I thought, is this a Muppets film or is this a Jason Segel vanity project? Because I don't know how much vanity project mileage I'm going to allow the man. You know, just enough to hang himself with, I think. But actually, having watched the film, I think he does a pretty damn good job of, as you say, essentially keeping his head down, and he seems to have been the right man for the job because he obviously appreciates that, you know, a Muppets film was about the Muppets, it's not about the star cameos or whatever, you know, and even Amy Adams. I mean, Amy Adams could make a toilet roll commercial, and I'm going to love it. I just think the sun shines out of her backside. But like, normally I'd be like, "Oh, Amy Adams been underused," but it's the Muppets. She's not underused. She's there for a purpose. She has a blast, and then, as you say, she gets out of the way and lets the Muppets do their Muppet thing, and it works fantastically.
Yeah, there's probably only one human person that I would like to see more of, but that's just because I generally want to see more of him anyway, and that's Alan Arkin as the studio tour guide. And
yeah.
Alan Arkin's a legend, but other than that, they do what they're supposed to. They get out of the way and let the Muppets get on with being Muppets. And there's already talk of a sequel, unsurprisingly. It seems to be quite a successful film for Disney. And Jason Segel's already said he'd probably be involved in the writing, but not starring in it again. Doing the right thing with the Muppets, people tend not to come back. So that's good.
I'd be interested to see if they ask Brett McKenzie to write some of the tracks again. Are you a man or a Muppet, Drew?
I would say he's a very manly Muppet.
I'm more of a Muppety man, really.
I was going to say, I think he's more of a Muppet of a man. Hey, ba-boom. Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, then, appears to be a film tailor-made to wind me up, and that's precisely why I have no intention of ever watching it. Drew. No, not Drew, oh. Scott.
Yes, likewise, I have no intention of ever watching it for exactly the same reasons.
Yes. Scott, you bore the pain.
Do we have to talk about this? Can we just lightly skip over it?
Works for me.
Okay. Go for it. Just give it all the regard it deserves.
Based, and this is your first warning sign, on the novel by a guy whose name I struggle to pronounce, but Jonathan, I'm okay with that part, but Safran Four, who also did...
One of several clones.
I believe he also did Everything is Illuminated. And all I've tried reading these books, and they're dreadful. He's got this habit of writing a central character who's like a 10-year-old, or in this case, 9-year-old kid, but who acts like he's 40. It's this sort of strange insertion fantasy. It's all a bit Mary Sue-ish, and I've never liked his work anyway. So I wasn't really looking forward to this film, to put it mildly, but what the hell, I had nothing else to do today, so I watched it, and it sucks. It is, I suppose, in all the kind of mechanical and boring senses, well made, and it's reasonably well acted. There are a couple of pretty good performances in there. Tom Hanks, you can't really argue with the man. He does turn and put a good turn in, and it does have a very good performance from Max von Sydow, for once not being the bad guy in it.
Steady on, I'll need a moment to take that in.
Even Sandra Bullock has quite a good performance. I should, I suppose, talk about the plot. Tom Hanks is Thomas Schnell, the father of Oscar, played by Thomas Horn. The whole gist of it is they have a fairly interesting relationship, although not one that is makes sense for a 9-year-old to have. He's, again, acting with knowledge far beyond his years. They have this whole thing of having like searches through New York and all this kind of thing. They're all very pally. This is brought to a crushing halt on September 11th. His father's killed in the World Trade Center. And after that, Oscar goes into his shell a little bit more. He then finds a key hidden in his father's possessions, it comes in an envelope with black written on it, and he has to unlock this final mystery to get clarity on his place in the universe or something like that. It's never much more than a framing device, and it's just quite annoying because the character is so annoying and the kid, Thomas Horn, is so annoying. And the first hour of this film's really almost impossible to watch without sort of clawing your own eyes out. It's just so irritating. The kid's just very, very annoying. I mean, he is understandably affected by what's happened, and he's become somewhat almost autistic, or Asperger's, I think he's referred to at one point. You know, but things like he's so afraid to go out in most places that he has to carry a tambourine around to calm himself down. Oh, Jesus, shut up.
A typical 9-year-old affectation.
I believe it's known as Dylan therapy.
He could have gone for the more controversial Bez approach of just carrying some maracas.
And walking forward a bit and back a bit in a comedy fashion.
He goes off on a scavenger hunt, essentially, as it was described here. He tries to track down everyone in New York with the surname of Black, which is the name that was on the back of the envelope this key came in, and try and work out what this key's for.
Did you say Black?
Yes.
Yes.
In a city of 9 million people?
Yes. Yeah.
A great deal of whom are of English descent or might have anglicised their name to Black. Well, that won't take him all his life.
No.
I assume it doesn't.
Luckily for us, no. No, it doesn't. Because I was glad when this film ended, so I'm very glad that it didn't take that long. And it doesn't actually resolve itself in any sort of satisfactory way either. It's nothing to write home about. The whole point of the thing is not so much that what's to do with this key, it's more the kid reconnecting with his mother at the end of the day. Sandra Bullock, who I have to admit, for once, fair play, very good performance.
Yeah.
Which is not something you would say much
about.
Well,
that makes two of her, I think, after The Blind Side.
It's not really worth hanging around for that revelation, though. I mean, it's almost the same kind of things that we'd be saying about Descendants. The first, 75% of the film doesn't really connect at all. But while that last gasp, last 25% of The Descendants was so good, it kind of more than made up for it. You don't have that kind of catharsis in Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. It is just continually annoying. And the fact that the kid gets marginally less annoying at the end of it isn't really something that's helping anyone out. I'm not entirely certain if it's supposed to be taken as some sort of parable towards America's recovery after September 11th. I get the impression that's what it is trying desperately to seem like, but it just isn't. There's no real relevance to September 11th at all, apart from the fact that his father dies, and this makes it seem awfully exploitative, but it's just one of the things where it's trying to craft meaning onto something that doesn't actually have any just by mentioning September 11th. Because it's, I mean, especially when the book came out, which wasn't all that long after September 11th for this kind of thing, but it's not really dealing with any of the issues raised by September 11th in anything more than the most tangential terms. And it's the same sort of, arguably less so, I suppose, than like the World Trade Center film, WTC, was it called? Or was it World Trade Center? Which was
the Oliver Stone one.
Yeah. Which was absolutely meaningless. That's more frustrating to me than anything else. Apart from the fact that it's just not a very good film in the first place, it's a film that seems to have ideas about its station. It's also a book that has ideas about its station. It's not just the film's fault, where it's trying to gain meaning by association, and that's a lousy trick. And I hope it doesn't work. It's just not a very good film. It has obnoxious performances, unbelievable characters, an unbelievable central tenet, and is frustrating in the extreme with the way it's trying to get meaning from something that it has no real point in claiming. If you'd changed his father dying in any other way, this film and book would have no relevance to anything.
Yeah, it sounds very cynical and exploitative.
Yes, so no, avoid.
It's that kind interesting of take on skipping over it there, Scott.
Yeah, it was
you
quite
don't
a thing.
When I get started,
I have to say that I steer well clear of this. I mean, after I saw the trailer, I thought, oh my goodness, this just looks like the worst kind of cloying, sentimental pap. It's that whole notion, that whole false notion of the city of New York coming together, kind of thing that so wound me up with these stupid bits at the end of the first Spider-Man film and whatnot.
That's terrible, that bit.
Oh,
it's like you pick on one of us, you're picking us all. And starts the Green Goblin. That's a terrible scene.
The notion that some annoying, precocious young kid could dance about some of the least salubrious parts of a city where I would be terrified to walk up to anyone and ask them what if they had the time on them, let alone anything else, and sort of be embraced by all these sort of various different communities and whatnot, and just be allowed to go on his way without getting hassle from anyone.
Including puzzlingly a homeless man that he found in a phone book. I don't understand how that works.
That's a bit of a mindfuck, that one.
What do you mean, how does that work, Scott? All he has to do is go X directory.
Sorry, maybe I've misunderstood that. Was he actually living in a phone book?
Yeah, a hollowed out phone book.
Yeah.
Man, the Manhattan phone book is big. Oh my goodness. Maybe it just has a section at the back of just like no fixed abode. But you can usually find them here.
This is the phone box closest to their street corner.
Yeah. It just struck me immediately as being something I should avoid, and I'm glad someone else has taken the time to watch it for me.
We suffer, so you don't have to.
Well, exactly. I tender my opinion on these things out at times like that, and I feel like I've had a good return on my investment there. John Carter, then. No relation to Jack Carter, I assume.
Who's Jack Carter? Should I know that name?
The girl in the film. Her name is that Carter. That's my name.
I was thinking his first name was Get.
And her father was my brother. And he was murdered last week. But that's got nothing to do with John Carter.
No, it doesn't.
No, who's going to talk about John Carter? Because I ain't seen that Red Menace.
I shall let the listeners know.
Excellent.
John Carter is something that's come entirely fresh to me, although apparently it's quite well known.
Yeah.
And from what I've read, is something that more or less most 20th century science fiction films seem to have stolen from willy-nilly for a long time, even though this has never itself been adapted that I'm aware of, to the point where quite a lot of the clichés of science fiction are apparently originated from this story. I have thus far been unaware of it. It's based on early 20th century serial called Princess of Mars by Tarzan author Edgar Rice Burroughs. And so John Carter is a tale of a former Confederate soldier turned gold prospector who is mysteriously transported to Mars, where he finds he has superpowers and, conveniently, a whole host of enemies and challenges to which you can apply these superpowers. I know there's not a great deal more to say. There's absolutely nothing to get excited about in this film. While the effects work is very good indeed, the story is no great shakes. It more or less boils down to evil man wants to marry princess. Princess runs away. Princess meets recently arrived stranger. Princess falls in love with stranger. Stranger fights bad man. That's the story. It just so happens that for some reason it's being done by a man who's being projected from his body into an alien body on an alien planet and is fighting with the natives. So much so, Avatar. The acting isn't fantastic either, but the leads, Taylor Kitsch and Lynn Collins, are engaging enough. And I guess some kudos must be given to Collins for delivering the ludicrous line, "This whole structure is run on 93 isolates with any degree of seriousness."
Say that again?
Yes, this whole structure is run on 93 isolates.
Okay.
It doesn't have any meaning, Craig, bloody, no matter how many times you hear it.
This structure's a bloody cowboy job. all those isolates are going to have to come out, love.
It's built on Seventh-day Adventists.
You know, some gravitas is added by voice work from Willem Dafoe, but other members of the cast, British character actors like Kieran Hines and James Purefoy and Dominic West and particularly Mark Strong are criminally underused. But none of that should matter, as John Carter is, or at least ought to be, an action movie. But it just never really gets going as one. You know, despite the potential granted by huge monsters, hordes of tribal four-armed horned reptiles, dragonfly-inspired flying machines, and a budget of $250 million, the action scenes never seem to really rise above. Meh. There's no memorable set piece, there's no outstandingly choreographed fight, and the movie suffers for it. Director Andrew Stanton, most notably of WALL-E, seems to have been too focused on making the creatures and vessels look good, and not focused enough on what to actually do with them. I mean, oddly though, while I wouldn't call John Carter a good film, I couldn't call it a bad film. It's reasonably entertaining, and at 2 hours 10 minutes, it passes surprisingly quickly, certainly far more so than Avatar, which is, on so many levels, its obvious comparison point. And on the other side, it isn't Avatar, it doesn't have Sam Worthington in it, it isn't really, really boring, but it's no great shakes either, but I guess it passed the time well enough, I can't say I was bored by it. With that budget, and the cast that has, it really ought to have been so much better. Mm. Even if the story was no great shakes, just, it seems that all of the resources, the money, the people, the director, everything, it's just less than the sum of its parts, really.
Mm. What fascinates me about it is I'm just looking here. I mean, it's been out, a week now? And there's a fantastic headline here in the IMDb news section. Fans petition for a John Carter sequel while Disney tries to figure out who to blame for the movie. Right? If you want to look to blame, I think perhaps they should look at themselves. It fascinates me that they would give a film that kind of budget, and I've seen like no press for it, man. And also this bizarre marketing move where they decided at the last minute to change the title from John Carter of Mars to just like the electrifying title John Carter, because
which makes it sound like it's about a character from ER, yeah. Which would have been a far more compelling story given that ER was a very good program.
Exactly, but apparently they've done it because they were afraid that sci-fi films are a difficult sell, and they put audiences off. That's why Avatar did so shite.
Yeah, despite the fact it wasn't any good.
Who do you think they're going to fool with that? It's like, oh, there's a film called John Carter, let's go and see that. Oh, this is about science fiction, I've been robbed.
Yeah, exactly.
I know some people just show up at the movies, the theatre, and just pick one at random, but surely...
I can't believe it's many. And the chances of people turning up in the cinema where John Carter's out and not at least seeing a poster, which may only say John Carter, but has a picture of a desert landscape, yeah, with enormous CGI monsters on it, probably going to get a fair idea of what it's about.
I don't know, man. It seems like such a bizarre decision for them to make. I mean, obviously I haven't seen the film, so I can't comment, but $250 million is a lot of money to ask to get back when you're not particularly willing to sort of give the film the conviction of your commitment to it. So
one thing that does stand out, but the only remarkable thing about it is the same. It's not terrible. It's not in any way good by conventional measures of good. It's entertaining enough. The only outstanding thing is that somehow Andrew Stanton, director of WALL-E, of all things, managed to get a decapitation into a Disney movie.
Cool.
But that's basically its only selling point. Mm. That distinguishes it from any of its competition.
I don't know. Well, yeah, I like John Carter well enough. I think it's probably just been missold to people, or possibly just not being sold at all to them as part of the
issue. Very possible. I said I don't recall having seen... I don't think I've seen a single trailer for that, actually. And
no.
There seemed to have been a great deal of marketing, which is weird for a company that's A, Disney, and B, invested $250 million in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Puzzling, I more or less agree. I probably liked it a little bit more. I quite like Dominic West's sort of second string bad guy, slightly stupid routine. I thought that was quite good, but there's an awful lot of elements here, and none of them quite gel together, I think, as well as people would have, well, certainly as I would have wanted. Everything seems to be there, it just doesn't quite tie up. I mean, I will say it does probably look about $250 million. I've not seen better effects work. The effects are fantastic.
It's just that, I've already said this, but the director doesn't really seem to have known what to do with them. He's look really, really pretty, but then the action scenes, they're so unmemorable.
Yeah, it's just basically a guy jumping around a lot, which is fine if you're Super Mario, but not so much for John Carter. I like the character of John Carter. Taylor Kitsch is quite a charismatic performance.
Given that he's not got a lot to do other than basically look like He-Man,
yeah,
he's quite engaging.
And for a disposable action hero, he's got a better backstory and he feels more human than most of the action heroes you would have jumping around. It did feel quite well handled in that respect, which I guess is what you get when you come from a respected writer.
Yeah, you've got somebody who's already been through one war and really, really doesn't want to be involved in fighting again, which is much more interesting than most of them. It's like most action films with the former soldiers, like, well, I'm just going to kill all the people then, yes.
But yeah, if it's action scenes aren't delivering, then it'd have to fall back in the plot, and I really didn't understand what was going on for most of it. I mean, there's a whole 10-minute section, give or take, where the film grinds to a halt and Mark Strong tries to explain why he's doing what he's doing, and it was left none the wiser at the end of it.
Yeah,
it's very opaque.
The main plot, I guess, is kind of an analogy of the US Civil War, which has happened kind of 50 years before it was written, and this guy's meant to have gone through it. So you've got somebody else, you've got these two people who represent the Union and the Confederates fighting each other in the Civil War, and one people that could quite easily represent Native Americans kind of caught in the middle, and the the fight for the country or planet, as you want to see it. And that's all kind of easily understandable. Then you've got these super-duper aliens, headed by Mark Strong, who are manipulating stuff for some reason. That's about, I've no idea why they're doing it. They're like, we're messing with all these people's lives because we can. And that's not a compelling reason.
I think plot-wise, it's a huge pill for me to swallow from the off. Depending upon, I mean, obviously, well, the novel, rather the film, depending on which way the wind's blowing that morning, I'm going to feel very strongly either one way or the other about a film whose plot is, this guy's fighting in the American Civil War, and then he's on Mars. Aye?
Oh, no, he's not fighting in the American Civil War. Oh, he's starts off after that.
Yeah, after that.
He's become a gold prospector.
Yeah, okay, you know, but Drew, all of a sudden he's on Mars.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Except he's not actually on Mars. It's a projection.
Does that make it more
or
less...
Which is what makes it quite like Avatar.
Does that make it more or less ludicrous? It's like, okay, yeah.
I don't know, you've got
I'll
the thing
with
this. It's just the fact that it's based on a 1912 story, which is only in the really early years of real science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe a couple of decades after Jules Verne really started the whole thing off, him and H.G. Wells. So the original stories from when these stories are likely to be less sophisticated and people are considerably less jaded about them.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a curious choice to actually make this film now.
Mm. Well, apparently Stanton's been trying to make it for ages.
Well, if you did something very similar, but sort of call it, you know, Dave Carter, and, you know, have it not be on Mars, but it's on some other alien planet or something. I think it's everyone gets hung up on the Mars. I mean, I certainly did. I mean, in the first 10 seconds of this movie, it says, paraphrasing only very slightly, it's like, you think you know about Mars? Well, you don't. It's called Barsoom, and it's got an atmosphere, and there's these races, and they're fighting, and there's these green people with four arms.
The fact that it's Mars is a moot point. It's just because at the time, obviously, the novel was written, it was the only one of the planets in the solar system we vaguely knew anything about.
Although even, well, I'm not quite sure that's accurate, but even though, by that point, sort of the archetypal film about people, aliens from Mars, had already been written, which is War of the Worlds.
Mm. That's what I mean. There was a fascination with Mars at the time.
I'm watching this at the start, and it really did. It's not a bad film. It's reasonably enjoyable. It took me a while to get into it. I wasn't quite as down at the beginning of Scott, but 10 seconds in it, in the cinema, Scott turns to me and says, this is already the dumbest film I've ever seen, where they're trying to explain that you don't know about Mars.
And it turns out that actually didn't bother me at all when it was revealed as sort of part of the way that it envelops, which is to its credit. It makes you swallow a very large pill, as you say. But I could easily have figured what it said in that first couple of seconds by myself, and it would have been...
Yeah, it really, really didn't need the prologue, and it probably could have done without the odd subplot too with John Carter's nephew, who happens to be Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although, I don't know whether that was actually affected or not by the fact that the kid playing Edgar Rice Burroughs is terrible. And the only thing I can ever remember seeing him in is one of the least likeable characters I've ever seen in cinema in World's Greatest Dad.
I did wonder how that was going to play, because I did notice in the cast list there someone credited as playing Edgar Rice Burroughs. So,
It's odd, but it did take me a while to get into it, to like, sort of sit back and start enjoying it. Because I'm sitting here watching a film about Mars and think, Kohei could better bloody well turn up sooner, I'm leaving.
They've missed an opportunity there. It should have been Jack Carter of Mars. And after the end of Get Carter, when he gets blatted by the guy with the rifle, that's the point at which the character should have been projected to Mars. Think of the havoc Jack Carter would have raised on Mars.
You're a big green man with four arms, but you're in bad shape.
You're out of shape.
For me, yeah. Full-time job.
throwing Alf Roberts off the top of the face of Mars, whatever that damn thing was called.
It is kind of disappointing, just because it's got so many elements in it. The director's got a really good look, he's got some really good actors at his disposal, and there's no Sam Worthington in sight. It's just, it's really quite disappointing, even though it's enjoyable as it may be. It could have been a great deal more.
So then, The Woman in Black, in which our friend Daniel Radcliffe is his first role post-Harry Potter, isn't it?
First major on film screen, role.
Yeah,
I
his
imagine.
First major film role post Harry Potter.
He's done some theatre stuff like Equus.
Yeah, yeah, we know that, but I mean just his first film role. For which he has decided to set up his stall with Hammer Films. There we go, the newly resurrected Hammer Films. And quite the business The Women in Black is doing, is it not, Drew?
I have no idea.
You haven't seen is this one of the ones you haven't seen?
I haven't seen it.
Because
it's a horror film, so I assumed it was shit and didn't watch it. And if people who have seen it are better to tell me I'm wrong, that's fine, but this has been my experience in life so far, so it'd be unusual for me to be wrong on this.
So then, The Woman in Black sees him playing a young widowed lawyer who travels to a house, or was it Eel Marsh, Scott, if I remember correctly? A creepy old house on Eel Marsh where everybody sort of says, don't go there. Bad things happen there. To take care of some lawyer-type business and get some scares from someone faffing about in the house. That's my summation of it. Yeah, Women in Black, Daniel Radcliffe, Hammer Films, Scary House.
Is that the house making that noise?
Pick up the baton, Scott.
About a year or a half ago or something like that, I came to the same conclusion as Drew eventually did. As you'll probably remember, Greg, me and you, suffering through God knows how many dreadful horror films in the hope of finding one good one before, I think eventually we all kind of moved away, and we came to the conclusion that all horrors are shit, and the ones that aren't shit are so rare that they may as well not exist, and we can just discount them as a rounding error.
Statistical anomaly. Yeah.
So I hadn't watched a horror film in a good long while, so it's not perhaps that much of a praiseworthy statement to say this is the best horror film I've seen in some years. However, it is. And it's not because it's a good horror film, it's because it's actually a quite good film. Far from the best film we've seen in, well, we're talking about in this podcast, and far from the best film we've seen this year, but it's actually pretty good. Very competently told. Daniel Radcliffe turns out, I mean, we've been watching him progress, and I think if you go back over Harry Potter and the whatever reviews, you'll find us getting progressively more impressed with Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah,
but now
he's clearly gone better over the years.
Yeah, he's now actually good. This is a good performance from Daniel Radcliffe.
How is he with emotion in this, Scott? Before you go on to the rest of the film, because that's the one thing that, even as he was noticeably getting better in Harry Potter films, the one thing he was a decided Achilles heel from was like real emotional scenes. Is he better with that, or does he not have a chance to do that?
For the most part, Ulrich did really do a bit sad and scared, and he does those very well. I was thinking this. I have no complaints with his performance. I think the only complaint I have is not with his performance, but with the fact that I felt that the character was written to be about 5 to 10 years older than Radcliffe actually is.
He's miscast.
He does look quite young from what I've seen of the trailer, certainly.
Yeah. I hope this isn't just me sort of mentally typecasting him, because obviously we've known this kid since he was a kid.
Because I've paid no attention whatsoever to the Harry Potter films, and I can tell you he is just miscast.
That minor thing aside, I think he does every bit as well as you could expect in this, and this is a very well-made film. Very, I was going to say competently shot, but that's damning it with faint praise a little bit. It's actually very nice in certain places. It's a well-made film, it's well-crafted, lots of good performances. I don't know what the fuck Victorians were thinking when they designed toys for kids, but these things are creepy as hell.
Symbol monkeys!
Oh, Jesus. And I think you mentioned one of the tweets, there are a few actual proper creepy moments, and for once, it's not just because it goes quiet and then it makes a loud noise. There's bits in here that it genuinely builds up a very creepy atmosphere, and then it does something creepier, which makes you go, whoa, a little bit. And it's the first horror film I've seen in a good long time that has had any kind of reaction like that from me. I enjoyed it, which is something I will very rarely say about any horror film, and certainly anything made in the last 5 years. I mean, God, what have we had? Various Saw films and The Human Centipede. You know, this is leagues ahead of it. This is actually a very well-made film. It's well-crafted. I mean, the actual central story, you've seen a million times before. It's a very standard ghost story setup. It's very run-of-the-mill and, I suppose, very Hammerish. But that, again, that's kind of the point of it. It's a safe re-establishment of the Hammer horror brand. Okay, it's not redefining cinema, it's not redefining horror, but this is a very solid entry, and I was very impressed with it. Maybe that's because I had such low expectations going into it. But, yeah, I actually quite liked it. I mean, I'm not going to say it's certainly not the best film of the year, not the best film of this podcast even, but it's, if you're in the mood for a horror film, I would recommend this over anything I've seen in the last 5, 6, however long we've been doing this, 10 years or something.
So you're suggesting, Scott, that if I were to actually break my embargo, this may be the film to do it with?
Yes. I would say so. Very strong candidate. Well shot, atmospheric, well paced, creepy at points, and not just for volumetric reasons of just playing loud noises at you.
I'll be interested to see how Hammer progress from here, because Wakewood last year, because I didn't really know what to expect from this. Wakewood last year, or possibly was it the year before? No, I think it was last year, was like an interesting film, like zero budget, with some interesting ideas that took a more kind of adult-oriented... It was trying to be a cross between sort of like Don't Look Now and The Wicker Man, essentially, I suppose, that sort of thing. Very low budget, very down and dirty, and it didn't really succeed in all levels. And, like, Woman in Black, it couldn't be more of a contrast. It's like this really sort of high production value thing that's like, from the off, it's immediately obvious that they've spent a decent amount of money on this. They've got a good cast, but like the sort of the production design is really good. The sort of the costume design and all that sort of stuff. The effects works as sophisticated as the effects work needs to be in a film like this is well done. But the story is nowhere near, the story's a much more well-worn trope, yeah, I suppose. Yeah. Like you say, I mean, it's nothing you haven't seen before, but it's consummately done. And I'd be surprised, well, I'd be interested to see if this is the way Hammer are going to work now. Like every couple of years, they're going to put out a sort of, they're going to throw money at something like this, which they're not going to take a gamble on the story. They're going to do something that they know is going to appeal to a broad audience and use that to fund sort of these interesting little films in between. That would be an interesting thing for them to do. That's what I would like to happen. Whether or not that's what is going to happen, I don't know. But my issues with Daniel Radcliffe being miscast age-wise, I mean, if not experience-wise, I was pleasantly surprised by how he carries the role. I just didn't buy into his fresh-faced character as being this widowed lawyer, father of, you know, two children, am I correct in saying?
Just the one.
That aside, like, yeah, I mean, the first hour or so I felt was like, it didn't build up as much atmosphere as I think maybe it would like to have thought it had. But by the time, you know, the story gets going, I mean, you gradually get drawn into this. Before you know it, you're sort of like zoned in on this thing and it's got your attention. And the last half hour of it gave me like three chills, which, as you say, is more than any other film I've seen recently. And just goes to show that actually, I mean, this is working within the framework of a 12, which a certificate, which I know for the UK meant some sort of like toning down and a couple of minor cuts to keep the 12 certificate, but I don't think it's anything that would have hamstrung it too much. Like I think the inevitable uncut, too scary for cinema version, which will get released on DVD, isn't going to be a revelation in terms of like suddenly there's going to be gore thrown at the screen or anything.
Blood would probably detract from this than help it, I think.
But what I'm most pleased about with The Woman in Black is that it goes to show that actually what's scary aren't things that get you an 18 certificate. There's nothing scary about any 18 certificate, inverted commas, horror film that I've seen. 18 just invariably means dismemberment.
It just means gore, generally, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And there's no gore whatsoever in this film, and it managed to unsettle me. It managed to genuinely unsettle me, like, two times, and on top of that, there was, like, just a ooh moment kind of thing. That's the only way I can think to describe it. And it's a 12 certificate film. Here's the news, 15 maximum, but you can make a scary film. There's no excuse for throwing buckets of gore at the screen. If you do that, all you're hoping to achieve is to attract a very stupid, immature audience. The Woman in Black has now definitively proven that, and like, audience reactions to it would seem to back that up immensely. Even this sort of like slightly neutered version that we've got here in the UK still seems to be sending the willies up people. So, man, like I'm all for it, and I'm really going to be interested to see what Hammer do from now on. If this is how they're going to roll with it, then man, more power to them.
Yeah, well, just look at the huge number of like scary stories there are for children. Mm. It doesn't need to have like gore or bad language or sex or anything. Yeah. Stuff could be scary, and it's deliberately written for children.
Yeah,
and it's hugely popular and always has been.
But at the same time, I wouldn't be taking a child to see this, man. Now that I've seen it, it's not like Spider-Man, where you probably like an 8-year old would have been all right going to see it. Like, I wouldn't take an 8-year old to see The Woman in Black. It's not. It's one of those where you think to yourself, "Oh my goodness, yeah." If I had seen this when I was like 8 or 9 years old, I'd probably have lost a bit of sleep over it, man.
I'll give it this right. I can't really think of anything, and if this doesn't sound it, I apologise, but in my mind, this is as high praise I can think of for a horror film. The phrase thrills and chills is thrown around a lot with the kind of horror genres. I've never really quite understood what it is. that kind of, you know, cold tingling up the back of the spine kind of feeling. And I've only ever had that before at the first time I watched The Ring, the very end of that. And I got it a couple of times during this film. And that is, like, possibly the only times in my film-watching career that I've really felt that. I mean, a couple of times I've jumped because it's made a very loud noise at me or something like that. But this is the first time I went, oh, God, that's just a bit creepy.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's my verdict on it. It creeped me out a couple of times, and that's really what I would want from a horror film. So,
And once again, key, and we've spoken about this numerous times on the rare occasion where something, where tension has been built in the film,
sound design,
largely through the use of sound design. Mm-hmm. Sound design that doesn't involve stabbing you in the ear with an orchestra.
Exactly.
No, that's very, very clever and skillful.
Yeah. And there are a couple of...
And isn't overused at all either.
And there are a couple of bits where that sort of thing's almost... thrown at you, but it's kind of you forgive it. It's not actually any really the sort of peak scary moments. Don't rely on anything like that. Well, they wouldn't be peak scary moments, I suppose. So pleasantly surprised. It's not my favorite horror film of all time, but I think in time it's going to prove itself to be quite an important horror film. So yeah, well done, Hammer, man. I'm impressed. There we go. That was a fairly mixed bag for you, lovely lot. This time round, I guess, are we going to try and be back with our audience?
Let's not commit to any sort of time frame because we'll just fail to meet it.
No, let's do commit to a time frame.
just so we can disappoint them again.
Yes. 2 weeks? Yeah, 2 weeks. I'm with that.
Yep.
Let's do it. Yes, all right. Hopefully it won't be so long. Again, we always end up saying this, but hopefully it won't be so long before we speak to you again. But thanks for listening, guys. I, as always, have been Craig. Scott was Scott.
Goodbye.
And Drew was invariably Drew.
Adieu.
Speak to you all soon. Bye.
Gavel,
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 gavel.